These are the stories you should know about today. Zelensky is not going to get his beloved Tomahawk missiles. I'm going to tell you why. One of the highest-ranking British officers says Ukraine cannot win because it doesn't have enough soldiers. And he does so as reports come out that indicate hundreds of thousands of Ukraine soldiers have deserted the battlefield. And a former UN weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, is going to join me right here, sit next to me. He just told me he was offered a bribe of $6 million to do what? I'm going to tell you right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And there is a lot of news suddenly on the Ukraine front. Gotten cold. All of a sudden, it's a hot story. The most current, President Trump met with the unelected leader of Ukraine. It did not go well. Nope. It did not go well at all for Mr. Zelensky. The meeting was described as tense, again, emotional. And at the very end, the president of the United States ended the meeting with Zelensky by just saying these words. I think we're done here. You know, you never want a meeting to end with those words. Look, Zelensky is simply not in a good place right now. He is losing militarily. There's no doubt about that. His approval numbers are horrid amongst his own people, right? And his soldiers are deserting along the front lines. In fact, the picture is so bleak, even a British field marshal, right? British keyword field marshal and five-star commander says it's over for Ukraine. Let me show him to you. This is the guy right here. This is a field marshal, and Lord David Richards is his name. He's one of the highest-ranking officers in the British military. And he's just come out, and he said that Ukraine cannot win its war with Russia and should negotiate peace terms now. Why? He says, look, they just don't have enough soldiers. And they can't depend on NATO. NATO will not and should not, he says, fight this war for them. Here he is.
What we have done in the case of Ukraine is encourage Ukraine to fight, but not give them the means to win.
Well, it isn't that. That's not the same, though, surely, as saying they can't win. It is, given the right resources, they could win,
yes,
which is my view.
Yes. My view is that they would not win.
Couldn't win, no. Even with the right resources.
And no.
Really?
No, they haven't got the manpower. Unless we were to go in with them, which we won't do because Ukraine is not an existential issue for us. It clearly is for the Russians. By the way, you can say, don't be ridiculous. NATO's not a threat. That doesn't matter.
They're perceived to be a threat.
The Russians view it as a threat. And actually, yeah. The Americans, under the Monroe Doctrine, would never allow China to get a foothold in Mexico, for example. So there's a certain hypocrisy in the West stance on this.
Did you catch that reporter for The Independent, the way he was hammering him with, no, please tell me they can win. Please, if we just give them more weapons, maybe then they can win, right? Did you notice that? How this corporate hack is trying to egg the commander on, trying to disagree with him, saying that NATO should fight in Ukraine against Russia. Easy for him to say. So here's what makes Lord Richard's point so illustrative, right? Take a look at this. This is an article from Inside Ukraine, no less, and it seems to underscore what this field marshal is saying. According to reports logged in Ukrainian courts, close to 300,000 soldiers have deserted or simply quit or just walked away, disappeared from the battlefields. And the numbers are going up. Every single month, not down. They're going up every single month. And what does that explain? Well, it likely explains why Zelensky is so hell-bent, so desperate for a Tomahawk missile. He wants this big, long-range missile because he wants to use it. And he doesn't know how to use it. He doesn't have the guidance systems. He'll have the U.S. use it. Or first give it to them, and then they can fire it off for him as well. And why is it that the Tomahawk is so important? Let me explain that to you. It's really about distance, because it has a reach of 1,500 miles. That would allow from Ukraine, even from Kyiv, to be able to hit cities in Moscow and other cities. in Russia. You see, as it stands, Zelensky cannot win this war, as it stands. But he can make a lot of noise with something like a tomahawk. And by making a lot of noise, he can hopefully then hope to drag the United States deeper into a direct conflict with Russia. If that happened for Zelensky, that would be ideal. The problem is, Mr. Trump, so far, or just recently, just within the past 24 hours, doesn't seem to want to go along with Zelensky's plan.
We need tomahawks, and we need a lot of other things that we've been sending over the last 4 years to Ukraine. We've been, you know, we gave them a lot. Now we have a different situation. We send it to the European Union. They pay for it and all that, and they have plenty of money. But it's beyond the money. You know, we need tomahawks, and we need a lot of other weapons that we're sending to Ukraine. One of the reasons we want to get this war over is exactly that. So we're going to be talking about tomahawks, and would much rather have them not need tomahawks.
So that was part of a media event, by the way, where you just saw the president speaking. That was held with the president's cabinet there around him, as well as reporters surrounding all of them. This came after the president's private meeting with Zelensky, where I told you it was tense and it went horrible. But this thing here they did afterward, it was like a kabuki dance. I watched it this morning. I mean, complete with Zelensky wearing a weird costume that many, including the president of the United States, kind of made fun of again. Ukrainian reporters were flown in from Kyiv to ask pro-Zelensky questions. MAGA reporters were there to ask pro-Trump questions. Kind of weird, if you ask me. Then there was this meeting. Look what I found for you. This is the meeting before the meeting. Here's Zelensky and his team from Ukraine. Before meeting with Trump, they went right to the source. The hell with Trump and the hell with... Well, look, why meet with the people elected by the people of the United States when you can go right to the source? The real bosses, the weapons makers, who stand to make billions of dollars off of this war. Look at these people. That's the CEO of Raytheon and other U.S. military companies, otherwise known as the deep state, or what some people even call the people who really run America. However, all of the signals seem to indicate that even those guys, those people that I just showed you, the all-powerful ones, right, even they can't help Zelensky. Trump is not only saying to Zelensky, sorry, no tomahawks, he's also warning Zelensky. Did you hear about this? Within the last 48 hours, Trump came out and told Zelensky about his own imminent destruction if he doesn't cede territory to Russia, territory the Russians say is theirs and have already won. And then there's the fact that Trump and Putin are about to meet in Hungary. Again, that works against Zelensky because Hungary is a country friendly to both, where they're not only meeting to end the war, they're also meeting to talk about repairing relations between the two superpowers. Imagine that, Russia and the United States starting to develop relations once again. That, too, would be very bad news for Zelensky. But you know what the worst signal that was sent to Zelensky while he was in Washington was? You know, I'm a big fan of optics, right? I think optics tell us everything sometimes, right? Show me the picture and I'll tell you what's going on. You know, it's more important than the words or the story. This time what happened in Washington was, well, it's what happened to Zelensky before leaving Washington. So he, listen to this. He calls a news conference, right? But he's not allowed to use the White House. He's already been told, bye-bye, you're good, by the president. He's not allowed to use another government building or the Capitol inside or even as a backdrop. So instead, he goes across the street to a park and stands by himself there at the park, where he tried again to make his case for more money and more missiles. But look how lonely he seems to look there. This time, few were listening. I counted the number of mic flags, you know, and that tells me what it is, right? And what do you think? I mean, I counted them. 6, maybe 5, maybe 7 reporters. Look at the mic flags. Look at them. See that right there? That tells you how many. Each one of those mic flags represents a reporter. How many were in attendance? Not many. That's how he left Washington. That is not a powerful exit. So, look, earlier today, I got a chance to discuss something about these topics with somebody who I think is probably one of the smartest guys I know when it comes to military and diplomatic affairs. He's a military expert who can break down for us what's really going on in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. My interview with none other than Scott Ritter, right here, sitting next to me, when we come back. For many of these topics that we have been discussing, I can't think of someone more appropriate to discuss these with than Scott Ritter, who's good enough to join us here. Scott, as you know, is one of the most courageous voices in the world. He's a former UN weapons inspector. He's also a Marine, something he boasts about proudly because it's part of who he is. It's part of his man. Am I right? I mean,
best career choice I ever made was going to the United States Marine Corps.
Why do you say that?
Character development. You learn so much about yourself. The values that the Marine Corps instills. You know, it's not just about saluting smartly and obeying orders unquestionably. And in fact, it was the exact opposite. It was about saluting smartly, but then smartly obeying orders and questioning orders when necessary, to be mission-focused and to encompass integrity into everything you do. It's just one of the, like I said, it's character development. I wouldn't be who I am today if it weren't for the United States Marine Corps.
You know, we all have that thing. I think because I grew up Catholic, there's a certain morality that I carry with me everywhere I go, where I have a really hard time lying, deceiving, being, you know, just generally losing my principles. That's important to me. And, of course, it came from my mother and my father as well. And you put it on your experience in the Marine Corps, and so do a lot of other people. It's sad at this point in our lives and in this world that my country that I adore, the United States of America, which was built on some of the greatest principles ever written into a book, the Constitution, now acts in ways that are contrary to my Catholicism, your Marine upbringing, right? How do we put those back together? How do we put the toothpaste back in the jar?
I don't want to be oversimplified, but, you know, I'm sure you, when you grew up, we're about approximately the same age. I might be a little bit older than you, but do you remember there was a TV show where they, you know, I'm just a bill up on Capitol Hill, yes. And they walk you through the whole thing.
We all grew up with it, yeah.
And you learned about civics. You learned about the responsibility of government, the role that the people played, and you learned that as a child.
Yeah.
So you realize that all that stuff that's happening up there is not only to benefit you, but it comes from you. You know, that we, the people, have a responsibility to guide those whom we elect to higher office to do right by us. And if they don't, we hold them to account, that there's this circle of accountability. But that requires civics. That requires a foundation of citizenship. I don't think we train our youth today to be good citizens. Hmm. We train them to be good consumers, consumers of digital information, consumers of products. But to be honest, you know, my wife, who immigrated to the United States from the Republic of Georgia, she had to take a test to become a citizen of the United States, a test on the Constitution. And the passing score is 100%. Hmm. And she passed it. She's a citizen. If we gave that same test to every American today, I'm guessing that over 90% of Americans would fail that test, which means...
I had to take that test.
Yes.
I became a citizen.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But that, you know, it's ironic that the immigrant population in America today that's being so maligned and you know, immigration this, immigration that. First of all, we're a nation of immigrants. Mm. And the grandchildren of immigrants have forgotten this. And they think they're empowered. They think that they are privileged. They think they are exceptional. And this carries over. You know, we keep talking about American exceptionalism. You know, they talk about America's the exceptional power in the world today.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? It's not a concept invented by the government.
Right.
It's a concept that the government breathes off of the people. Exceptionalism, you don't get to anoint yourself to be
exactly.
Exceptional. Exceptionalism is earned.
Yes.
You know, not given.
And yet, exceptionalism is Scott Ritter standing up to the powers of the world at that time, the Western world, who were trying to tell us that we should go to war with Iraq because they had everything to do with 9/11, they didn't, and because they had weapons of mass destruction, which they didn't. It would have been so easy for Scott Ritter to just go along to get along at that time.
And not just pushed... easy, but profitable.
Yes, right?
I had a $6 million offer put on the table in front of me by a very senior American official. All I had to do is play the game.
Really?
Yeah.
$6 million?
Yeah.
All you had to do was say, yep, I saw the weapons of mass destruction.
I didn't even have to do that. I just had to insinuate that Saddam was a liar, a cheater, and that weapons of mass destruction could exist in Iraq.
Why couldn't you do that?
Because it wasn't true. But the main reason why I couldn't do it is we go back to the Marine roots.
Yeah.
You see, when I joined the Marine Corps, I joined to serve my country. Now, I understand that I don't get to make the decisions about when we go to war and who we go to war with. That's the decision my leadership does. My job is to be prepared to carry out the mission when given by the government. But it's important that the mission be one worthy of the sacrifice we're asking the Marines to make. I know what we're asking of these Marines. I've been to war. Mm-hmm. And I know that when we go to war, people die. We kill a lot of them, but they can kill a lot of us.
Yeah.
And how do you write a letter home to a parent that says, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, sad to inform you that your son, Corporal John Smith, has died in combat? And how do I write a letter that makes them think beyond the tragedy to say, this was a sacrifice, the cause was worth the sacrifice.
It was worthy of your son's life.
Daughter, parents who receive letters that your son, your husband, died on D-Day, yeah, died on Iwo Jima, you know, at least they could be told that they died in you know, they sacrificed in support of a, yeah, cause worthy of the sacrifice. But to sit there and say, I'm going to lie to make $6 million,
yeah,
so that we can go to war, that we fought by Marines who are going to die. How do you write that letter to the parents? You can't.
Yeah.
You can't write that letter. So, nah, it just wasn't going to happen. Trust me, there were many times since then where I'm like, you know, when you're looking at the bills and you're looking at the bank account and you're going, God, how do I square this?
I know.
You're going, $6 million would have paid for a lot of, you know.
Not to mention, and we should maybe share this with our audience that's watching from all over the world, that not only was it the cost, the opportunity cost of what you didn't get that you could have gotten had you been less principled, but on top of everything else, for telling the truth, you were punished, maligned, and oftentimes criticized unnecessarily.
Yeah, you know, I can handle that. I mean, there's...
You're a big guy.
Well, it's not just that, but if you believe in what you're doing,
yeah,
then you have to be willing... Again, it comes back, you talk about your parents being a big factor for you.
Yeah.
You know, mine were the same way. I'll make this a short story, but I got in a fight in high school defending my sister's honor. And I got put down to the principal's office, and he called my father, and he said, your son's here. My father said, okay, why are you calling me? He said, well, your son was in a fight. Why are you calling me? Well, there's a penalty for fight. Why are you calling me? Was my son in a fight? Yes. Is there a penalty for fighting? Yes. Why are you calling me? He said, well, I have to suspend him. My father said, why are you calling me? So they suspended me.
Right.
So I got home, and I'm like, Dad, what? And he said, first of all, he said, I'm so proud of you for standing up for your sister. And had you not stood up for your sister, I would be ashamed. He said, so I'm proud of you. You're worthy of being my son. I said, so why didn't you come to my... He said, no. Hmm. There are consequences for action.
Yes.
And if you're going to take a correct action, thinking that you won't pay any consequences, it becomes easy to
you
do.
You still broke a rule. Right.
You have to be willing to pay the price for what you've done. Mm. And if you believe in what you've done, then it's a price you have to be willing to pay. I was told when I decided to resign from the United Nations, I was told by the head of the CIA station in New York that the FBI was going to come at me for the rest of my life. Gosh. He said straight up,
yeah,
if you resign, they will come after you, your family, your loved ones, everything forever. Are you prepared for that? Well, I mean, how can you say you're prepared for something like that? But I said, that's a price I have to be willing to pay to do the right thing. And they've been coming after me for, what has it been now, 20, 31 years, so... No.
Iraq war was based on a lie, and you were one of the few voices that stood up and described that lie. And we went to war anyway. Yeah. And today, everybody in the world seems to know we did it for a lie. And I guess we just move on to the next one.
Yeah, but they don't admit it was a lie. It was a mistake. You see, I mean, the decision makers.
But it wasn't a mistake.
No, they knew exactly what they were doing. The lie was manufactured to cover for it. But see, it's too easy. For instance, in the mainstream media, they say, well, we were lied to.
Yeah.
Well, isn't your job in the mainstream media to work through the lies?
Of course.
And if your job was to work through your lies, you had a guy named Scott Ritter, who was a chief weapons inspector running the intelligence programs, who knew everything about the WMD, telling you that this is a lie, and yet you ignored him. You went straight with the government message.
Right.
So it wasn't a lie.
I worked at CNN. I worked at Fox News. I worked at NBC. Scott, you know this. My job, especially when I was sitting at the anchor desk, I would get information tossed to reporter X, who's sitting at the State Department. They have breaking news. And then that reporter would literally say whatever they were just handed by the apparatchiks at the State Department, and they would report the news. So really, this Pentagon correspondent, or this State Department correspondent, or this White House correspondent, they're essentially apparatchiks themselves these days.
There was
in the United
only
States.
One news host who would call me up and ask me to come on and talk about the issue seriously. Only one.
Wow.
You. You were it. No one else. You were the only one who called me on, and you said a couple times, you know, they don't want me to talk to you, but I'm going to, let's do it.
Exactly.
So, again, I thank you for being the man to going for the truth.
Well, thank you. And I think that's important. And since we're into a little bit of this folkloric conversation about believing in things like principles that too often people don't believe in, you gave me this recently, and you said, the next time we see each other on air, I want to make sure you show it. So I made that promise to you, remember?
Yes, and you showed it. But now the problem is you've put it on the table. It's a challenge coin.
What does that mean?
I don't have mine on me.
Oh.
I owe you a drink. You got me, Rick.
That'll
you
be an old-fashioned, by the way.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about the news of the day.
A true old-fashioned or a real old-fashioned?
Yeah, I like the maple syrup, by the way. Let's talk about the news of the day. Something just happened. Two things, actually. One of them was the president of the United States just met with Volodymyr Zelensky, and he told him in what seemed to me no uncertain terms that the Tomahawks are off the table. The president's reason is that there's not enough Tomahawks to go around. Whether that's the real reason or not, it's a yet at this point, right? But then something else happened, and I think we may have some video we may be able to play. The delegation from Ukraine, including Mr. Zelensky, went and had a private meeting with the CEO of Raytheon and all the other special weapons manufacturers in the United States. And as I watched that video over the weekend, I just got this horrible feeling in my gut that why is the leadership of another country in my country not meeting with the people I elected, but rather with these private, greedy, I think, weapons manufacturers to cut some kind of deal outside of those people's meeting with the United States? It's almost like I felt, Scott, watching that, like they're going around my government and actually talking to the people who make the real decisions, talking to the real boss. That was my gut. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. Here's my problem. I'm sitting in Russia right now.
Yeah.
And in order for me to answer this question 100% honestly, I'd have to be very critical of my president. And I always hesitate to be critical of my commander-in-chief when I'm not in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to answer carefully here.
Well, I'm being critical of the people who I think are going around our president.
I'm not being critical of anything. I just, I leave in a couple hours to head back to the United States. I don't want the FBI to meet me at the airport and say, okay, come here, boy. Look, the president is navigating extraordinarily difficult political waters.
Yeah.
As you know, there is a deep state in the United States built around the military-industrial complex, around academia, intelligence interface, that for decades now have been selling the Russia bad, Ukraine good lie to the United States. And the president, I believe in his heart of hearts, wants to have better relations with Russia.
So do I.
But if he gets too far ahead, we have midterm elections coming up, which are critical for him for continuity of policy. He can't afford to have Congress flip. He needs Congress to stay Republican. Many of those people in Congress are part of this Russia bad, Ukraine good complex. Mm. But they also are linked to the president through Make America Great Again, et cetera. So the president is constantly struggling how to move towards peace with Russia without getting overextended and cut off.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of vacillation that's frustrating for people like you and me. I imagine it's horribly frustrating for the Russians.
Yeah.
Because one day the president says one thing, the next day he does another thing, one day he says something, and then Zelensky goes off and meets with the military-industrial complex. One of the mechanisms that President Trump has employed to disengage the United States from the Ukrainian conflict is to de-link the direct transfer of weapons from the United States to Ukraine. Mm. And so he's put in a mechanism where he calls upon Europe to buy weapons, put the orders in, and then the defense industry companies will sell that weaponry to Europe, who will then provide it. And what this does is takes his hands off, says it's not American money anymore. Mm. But it also creates a hugely complicated problem logistically, contract-wise, time-wise. The weapons that would be ordered there would not be delivered till 2027, 2028. And so what Zelensky's doing is going to meet with these defense energy people to see if he can shorten the delivery timelines. It's not going to happen. This is an exercise in futility. This is the president creating optics that America hasn't totally abandoned Ukraine, when the fact is we have totally abandoned Ukraine for the moment, because we never know next week when political winds change, what the president has to say something different. The other problem the president has is he's advised by people who know nothing about Russia.
Right.
Because this is as simple as it gets. Right now, I think at the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post have a headline that says that the deal that was cut between President Trump and President Putin was Donbass will be returned to the Russians and the line of contact will be frozen and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm someone who says, as an American, the Constitution is everything. That's what defines the Constitutional Republic. Without the Constitution, we don't have a United States of America.
Right.
And so I ask the American people, you guys understand that that's true, that's real. The Constitution is all important. Then why can't you respect the Russian Constitution? Why do you insult the Russian Constitution, insult the Russian people, insult the Russian nation by implying that they're willing to give up their territory? Because Kherson in totality, Zaporizhia in totality, Donetsk and Lugansk in totality are Mother Russia constitutionally.
Mm.
President Putin, with all due respect, has no authority to give away Russia to anybody. Mm. The Constitution prohibits. So he can't negotiate the surrender of Kherson, the surrender of Zaporizhia. And he will never negotiate that. He said so straight up. And one thing you have to learn about the Russian president is when he says something, he means it.
Well, there's also probably good news for Russia in that vein as well, because the president of the United States has just said to Zelensky, one of the other pieces of bad news that Mr. Zelensky, I guess, received from the president was not as adamantly as you just described it, but he basically said, sorry, you're going to have to give up. And the president called it property, because he's a real estate guy. But he meant the territory.
Well, he meant Donbass. There's still, Keith Kellogg is trying to tell this president to freeze the line of contact, and that'll become the demarcation line. See, the United States, the people advising the president still believe that the best way to end this war is a Korea solution, North Korea, South Korea, demilitarized zone. And again, I'm like, why do you disrespect the Russians so much? Why are you so ignorant about the reality of Russia? That's an impossibility. It can't happen. Because to make that happen, you would have to defeat Russia. And Russia doesn't get beaten. Ask Napoleon. Ask Hitler. Okay?
Yeah.
Ask the Swedes. 26 years to beat back the Swedish invasion. The Russians didn't surrender. Russians don't surrender.
History is replete with stories like you just mentioned. That's why this conversation that's about to take place in Hungary is very important between the president and his team and Mr. Putin and his team. Do you agree with me that this is a much better venue than Alaska?
What I would say is that this venue couldn't have happened without Alaska. That first we needed Alaska.
Mm.
That opened the door. That created, that took the conversations that were occurring since the beginning of the American presidency, of Trump presidency. Mm. You remember Marco Rubio meeting with Sergey Lavrov in Saudi Arabia.
Of course.
Et cetera. You know, that opened the door to Alaska.
And Istanbul before that.
And then Hungary is next. Hungary, I believe, is just another stepping stone. I think there's going to have to be another meeting. I don't think this thing ends until President Trump comes to Russia and closes that loop.
I think in many ways what I think, and I believe you believe this as well, is that it has to get away from being Ukraine versus Russia, when in actuality, in many ways, it's the West versus Russia, and it's the United States versus Russia. Let me speak plainly, and then let me get your reaction. The United States is not sanctioning Ukraine, it's sanctioning Russia. The United States is not giving weapons to Russia, it's giving weapons to Ukraine. So it's hard not to look at this in a black and white manner and say, I know you're calling yourselves mediators, and we appreciate that, the rest of us in the world. Happy to see that you're trying to come into this squabble and end it, but you're not really a mediator. You're a player.
You're an active participant.
You're wearing a uniform.
You're not just wearing a uniform. You're not a private, a corporal, a sergeant. You're the general.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing, is that it's not that just that we're a part of this system. We're leading this system. People need to remember that the United States had a policy under the Biden administration that sought the strategic defeat of Russia. Trump hasn't changed that policy. Hmm. And we know this because he continues to articulate aspects. For instance, when Scott Bessent says, I can collapse the Russian economy, that's part of a strategic plan to bring down Russia. And just so people understand, the strategic defeat of Russia isn't the battlefield. It's designed to bring about economic collapse, which brings about societal collapse, which brings about political collapse.
Right.
It is a plan to regime change.
Biden said it. He used those words.
He wants Vladimir Putin out of office.
Right.
And that continues to be the official policy of the United States, no matter how friendly Trump appears to be with Putin. Until which time Trump changes his policy, articulates it in public, what can Russia do? Because Russia knows behind the scenes they're continue to push. Bessent's words prove this. They want Russia to collapse. They want a change in the regime. So Trump has to change that. How can you trust the actor? This is another problem with arms control.
Right.
They want arms control. But the Russians are like, arms control is pretty cool. We understand the necessity of it. It's nice. But why would we even begin to negotiate limits on our strategic nuclear deterrent at a time when you're seeking our strategic defeat? Because the one thing that guarantees we will never be defeated is our strategic nuclear deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wall I run into every time I'm trying to promote arms control and I talk to Russians about it. And they're like, that's an old concept, Scott. It doesn't work anymore because your country can't be taken seriously.
Let me follow up with you on that point that we just made about the United States is basically giving Ukraine weapons, and they're castigating Russia in many, many ways. So they're not really a neutral party in this. So the only way for this to be handled properly is for the United States to come to Russia first and say, we want to be a neutral party. It means we're going to start lifting sanctions off of you, and we're going to stop giving weapons to Ukraine. Now you're a neutral party. The moment you do that, my opinion, I'm not an expert in military affairs like you are. My opinion, you just ended the Ukraine war when you do that.
Absolutely. But there's a problem because the United States, it's the United States that got Europe involved in this project.
Yes.
Because Biden, when
he's, and Obama.
Correct. But I mean, Obama first. Look, let's be honest, Trump. This is Donald Trump's war. He keeps saying it's not my war. It's his war. His first term in presidency, the Russians know exactly what he did. He provided weaponry. He encouraged 20 CIA bases were built in Ukraine to spy on Russia, including preparations for deep, direct action opportunities. Our special forces were in teaching. All these Ukrainian special operations that are taking place on Russian soil were trained by the United States. Intelligence was given. There are American attacks on Russian soil indirectly. The same thing with the British. The Russians know this. That was Donald Trump that made that happen, that created that. So it's his war. He just doesn't want to. But the United States sucked Europe into a war they really didn't want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And the Europeans now have committed extreme levels of political and economic capital to the renovation of NATO, making Europe prepared to fight a war with Russia. And so it's not going to be so easy for the United States.
So I think what you're saying, you're almost saying our president, your president and my president, wants to do that, but he just can't.
The system is not geared towards that. I'm not saying he can't. I'm saying he can't do it as quickly as you and I would like him to do it. Hmm. That there is so much entangled deep state nonsense, political nonsense. For instance, in order to do what you said, if you do it precipitously, where's NATO? Because basically it says we're walking away from NATO. This president's not prepared to do that. I think he might want to do that, but politically he can't do that. Remember, midterm elections, perceptions create their own realities. So this president has to play perceptions so that he's not seen as weak.
Although it seems to me, I don't know if you agree with me, that everything is moving in the direction of what we just talked about happening at some point. I just don't know if it's 6 months from now or a year from now, but it seems to be moving in that direction from what my sources are telling me in Washington, for example.
But look at every time the president takes a hard stance, he gets schooled on Russian reality.
Yeah.
Okay, and then he modifies his stance to adjust to reality, and then the politics comes in, his stance, you know, gravitates different direction. He received a 2.5-hour conversation with Vladimir Putin. We don't know exactly what they talked about. We know that it was frank.
Yeah.
When they say frank, that means disagreement. I believe he was schooled on Russian reality. And so his posture has adjusted. So every time, when we're speaking of moving forward, the thing that's pushing it is Russian reality. And so the tragedy is this war isn't going to end because like-minded people who want peace were able to impose peace on a violent situation. It's going to be because the violence will have progressed to a point where those who oppose peace have no choice but to accept peace.
Well, let me tell you what somebody says about this. I'm going to quote now Field Marshal David Richards. He is a commander, one of the top-ranking commanders in the British military, of all people, to be saying this. He says, quote, Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. It's absolutely impossible. They don't have enough manpower. They didn't have manpower enough to begin with, and they certainly don't have it now.
Yeah, and let me put a...
And this is a Brit.
Who are the most violent, war-prone people against Russia.
Yeah.
Let me put the Ritter corollary onto that. Europe cannot defeat Russia. Europe doesn't have enough manpower. Now, people will say, well, Scott, come on, Europe's population.
Yeah.
The Germans, you know, and the German government's one of the most rabid when it comes to, you know, posturing about the potential necessity of war with Russia by 2028, 2029. Mm-hmm. 16% of the German male population has said if Germany was invaded, they'd be willing to die for their country. 16%.
Wow.
All right? That's if Germany was invaded. Now imagine if Germany goes off to fight a war of aggression on another continent. You're not going to get the Germans mobilized to do that. You're not going to get Europe. European people do not want to go to war with Russia. And the only, because Russia's not coming to them.
Yeah.
In order to fight Russia, they would have to go to Russia. Europe doesn't have enough manpower. They don't have enough money. They don't have enough military power. So this general statement is 100% correct. The problem is the politicians have fooled themselves into believing that they actually, listen to Mark Rutte speak, listen to Starmer speak.
They von der Leyen.
Yeah, as if they have this massive army behind them. They've got nothing.
Just the opposite. As a matter of fact, over the weekend, there was another story that broke I'd like to get your reaction to, and that is in Germany and in several other countries around Europe, including Poland, and at least one other, which doesn't come to memory right now, they are literally trying to kick out all the Ukrainian refugees who are there, and they're telling them, you're no longer going to be on our welfare system, and you're no longer going to be able to get checks. You know, the party's over. You've been here way too long, and we just can't afford to support you anymore. We don't have enough money for ourselves. Similar to kind of what the United States message has been with many of their immigrants. Interesting that that would be happening right now. It reinforces the general's message and the message to me that Europe is finally saying enough.
Well, it's politics. You know, when it was politically viable, economically viable, Europe did this whole open borders, bringing the immigrants thing.
It's cost them billions of dollars.
Well, it's a losing proposition. They've ruin their societies because they didn't have effective plans for integration. And they've ruined their economies. And on top of that, this is parallel tracking with the disaster that is Ukraine. And so now they have collapsing economies. They're sending money to Ukraine. To defend sending money to Ukraine, Germany's talking about the reduction of social welfare programs. And then you have this huge Ukrainian refugee population.
And they're all wealthy Ukrainians who left and didn't want to fight.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, at a time when they're saying, the general, Ukraine doesn't have enough manpower. Well, geez, you got a couple hundred thousand military-age fighting men, but they're not men. They're boys hiding behind their mama's skirts in a foreign country. Real men would say, I mean, look, I believe that Ukraine has patriots.
Of course.
Most of those patriots are dead.
And the Ukrainians are great people.
They're great people. And, you know, there's that old story from Bakhmut where the Russians surrounded Ukrainian soldiers in the basement and said, brothers, come out. We won't kill you. You fought bravely. Come out. And you know what Ukrainian soldiers shouted back? Russians don't surrender. Because at their heart, they're the same damn people.
Yeah.
The same people. And they died because Russians don't surrender. Ukrainians... You know, let's put the banderas aside. The Ukrainian people are good people.
Yeah.
They're brothers, cousins, sisters, uncles, mothers, fathers of the Russian population. And they're the ones paying the price. You remember when the war started, how many hundreds of thousands of Russians fled? The Navalny people.
Mm-hmm.
The fake Russians. I'm sorry, I apologize to anybody. I'm sorry. But they fled.
Yeah.
These are the equivalent... These are the Navalny Ukrainians who fled because they don't love their country enough to stand up and defend it.
We've seen, as a matter of fact, I was just over the weekend preparing for this interview, and I looked at some of the latest stats on the people who are deserting in the Ukrainian army. It's mind-boggling. And if you look at the stat, you know, it literally goes up and up and up and up. Almost as if with each passing month, they have more and more desertions and they're running out of more and more soldiers. Meanwhile, from all reports that I've seen that are credible, most men in Russia are still wanting to easily, they're still voluntarily joining the Russian army.
Contract soldiers.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, you know, in America,
what does that say to you as a military guy?
It means that people are willing to fight and die for their country here, that there's a cause worthy of the sacrifice. Whereas in Ukraine, the Ukrainians no longer believe in the cause, that they're confused about the cause, and that...
That's big, isn't it?
Look, the Ukrainians have proven that they can die on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Die bravely on the battlefield. Meaning that, you know, there are Ukrainians who believe in the cause of Ukraine, defending Ukraine, etc. And I just had dinner with Abdi Aladanov last night, and he said, you know, when you face a brave enemy... You don't want to kill that enemy.
Yeah.
You want that enemy to survive, because when the war ends and that man is returned to his mother, the mother needs to know that the Russians are people with empathy, with a heart, with a soul, that they're not here to kill, that nothing, everything she was told bad about the Russians was a lie. Unfortunately, war is being what a war is. These brave men are dying. Now we have people who are conscripted. You know, want to know why we know these statistics? Because the Russians are capturing them. The Russians are feeding them. The Russians are caring for them.
Mm-hmm.
And when this war is over, Russia will return these men home to their wives, to their mothers, to their loved ones. And these people will know that Russia wasn't what Ukrainian propaganda said Russia was. We're looking at when the men, there's a sexist statement of me.
Yeah.
But when the men of a nation are no longer willing to sacrifice their lives for that nation, they haven't just lost faith in the nation. They've lost faith in their family, in their society, in everything. You know, you and I both know that we would die to defend our family.
Of course.
And then we also believe, you know, and that goes up. What's the circle where you stop and say, I'm not willing to die for this cause anymore?
Yeah.
And in Russia... The Russian men are willing to die for Russia, which means they're willing to die for everything in that circle. The Ukrainian circle is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
There's no question the Russians are winning this war, and I think every military expert, including yourself and McGregor and Mearsheimer and other people who are as smart as you are all pretty much saying the same thing. But why are the Russians going so slowly?
Again, strategically, you know, I am loath to pretend that I can speak on behalf of President Putin.
No, just from a military thing. You know military more than I do.
Well, first of all, this didn't start as a war, and people need to understand that. A war, when you draw big arrows, you're talking about the physical destruction of your enemy, the total collapse of society. Yeah. This is a special military operation.
Yeah, it's not Dredden.
So it started, the goal and objective was to get Ukraine to the negotiating table. Mm. And so Russia started, they made a move on Kyiv, they advanced. But the idea was to show Ukraine the consequences of failure to negotiate. 6 days after the special military operation started, Ukraine went to the negotiating table in Belarus. I think there were three rounds of negotiation mm-hmm. there. Then they moved to Turkey, ultimately to Istanbul, where we had the Istanbul communique, which was what Russia's goal of the special military operation was, a comprehensive negotiated settlement of all the issues. That's what this war was about. Then Ukraine withdrew from that, $48 billion infusion of military aid, and Russia had to transition to the next phase. And the next phase was the liberation of the Donbas. And then Ukraine did a counterattack. Russia had to stabilize the Serevikin line, mobilize 300,000, et cetera. It was never Russia's goal to drive to Berlin. The goal was always the Donbas first, but then in September of 2022, yeah. they were compelled to have referendum, and now you have Kherson, Zaporizhia. So the Russian goal is to take control of the territory that is Russia, but not throw away lives.
So no carpet bombing, no...
Well, the goal isn't the destruction of Ukraine.
Right.
The goal isn't the physical... If it was, Russia could physically destroy
Ukraine. Yeah,
look
how long it's taken to take Pokrovsk. And they still haven't. I mean, it's almost like they're going around, flanking all the way around and circling it rather than going in and...
Plus, those tactics are designed to actually preserve Russian life. Because, look, the Russians learned in Mariupol how deadly urban fighting can be. They learned in Bakhmut how deadly the direct attack in an urban environment is. And so the Russians are like, we're not playing that game. Russia's playing a different game operationally to shape the battlefield, to compel the Ukrainians to withdraw. Unfortunately, it's a war of attrition to kill as many Ukrainians as possible, to lower the numbers. That's the Russian priority. It's not to take territory. It's to wear the Ukrainians down to where they can no longer defend appropriately. But
attrition,
But controlled attrition, because it's not just a pure meat grinder. This isn't Rzhev. Anybody who studies World War II history will know about Rzhev. You've seen the monument at Rzhev, yeah. the soldier with the cranes. And you know, an acknowledgement of this wonderful song about cranes. This isn't that. This isn't where Russia's going to sacrifice 2 million soldiers to create a situation around Stalingrad. Vladimir Putin has met with the mothers and the wives of the fallen, and he understands the importance of those lives that are being sacrificed, and so he is not going to throw away lives needlessly. This war is bloody enough as it is. He's going to accomplish the mission and preserve, because if you start throwing away lives, you're going to have to mobilize. Right now, Russia has a system in place where they receive enough contract soldiers to not only absorb casualties, but to continue to grow, to give them greater opportunities. But if you throw that away, if you squander it in meat grinder assaults, this is new war. The conversation I had last night about drone warfare and how this is... The war that I was trained to fight doesn't exist anymore. This is a whole new war, and if you do it wrong, you die. And so the Russians are doing it right. They're winning. The Russians have always said that they aren't driven by an artificial timeline. They're driven by objectives and that they will accomplish it. The timeline is what we put on it.
Yeah.
But for the Russians, they're not doing that calendar stuff.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Well, I got to tell you, as a journalist, one of the great things about interviewing you, Scott, is you have that perfect combination of passion and smarts, and you also have a real sense of principle. And that's really an interesting thing in a human being. So I always get a kick out of spending time with you. I know I don't want to take more of your time. I know you got to jump on a plane, but it's really been nice to see you. Thank you for the visit.
Well, thank you, Rick. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for coming down. You're a good man, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Now it's time to take a look at our mailbag and see what you guys are saying. So Gary Odom writes from the Western United States. He says, "Morning in Moscow. That would be a great name for a show. You do great work, Rick. Hello from the great Northwest." Thanks, Gary. That's nice of you to say. Yeah, listen, I barely sleep as it is these days, but if I do decide to do another show, I'll think about that title. Black Cat is reaching out to us to say, you know, it is It is so nice to see how much you love your work and how much you enjoy the freedom of what you do. And then she says, by the way, many Europeans have no idea what BRICS is. Thanks. You know what? I do love telling stories, as long as they're based on facts. And no, that doesn't surprise me, what you say about Europeans. Their governments don't want them to know what BRICS is. Elaine Peter asks, Rick, do you believe that there will be a peaceful outcome? I have my doubts. Yes, I actually do, Elaine. I think the facts on the ground are leading us to the eventuality of Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin reestablishing ties in some way. And that will undoubtedly lead to peace. Finally, Macchio takes a good shot at me. He says, Rick, you're a typical American being brainwashed since childhood. The sentence about bad KGB comes from USA propaganda against the USSR. Guilty as charged, Mr. Macchio. I'm guilty as charged. If you've got some thoughts you'd like to share with us as well, just go to my YouTube podcast, Journalistically Speaking. Don't hold back, by the way. If you go to JSpeak, as we call it, let me know what you think, what you like, or even what you don't like. That's okay. I'm also on X, so look for Rick Sanchez TV there. Tens of thousands are there with you. We'll be looking for you next time. Thanks for letting us into your home. We'll be looking. Bye-bye.